Min campus alihor miaj karsten ŝwirep. Għakom għattilet program fit-tielet sensiela ta' minn Campus għal-iħor għawek fuq Campus FM inħallu dawk il-ħsejjes mill-proġett Mediterranju Medinea. Għedjem nir-ringrazzja l-Davinja Galia tal-appoċ bil-dik il-mużika u l-Arc Consultancy u l-grupp kollu li naqalta fil-proġett Ewropew illi ġibna wassalna għal dan il-programm u l-lum ħanibqgħu ħafna fuq il-mużika għaliex il-misti denti huwa Michael Quinton li huwa designer tal-ħoss, sound designer. Fil-fatt il-programm tal-lum ħejħu xejra forsi ftit differenti għaliex iktar ħajkun il-ħoss u s-siltiet mużikali illi ħajkunu il-qalba tal-programm. Aħna ħanitkellmu però iktar kważi biex nispjegaw x'ħankunu qed nisimgħu. Matul kollu Michael Quinton ħanidilkom xi ħaġa fuqu jirriċerka il-ħoss, l-użu tal-ħoss f'kuntesti differenti. Fil-fatt kif nisimgħu fil-programm ħammorru mill-ispazju sa l-irħula u t-toroq Maltin u nsegwu ftit l-effetti ta' relazzjoni tagħna mal-ħoss. Bħalissa jaħdem bħala freelancer, fil-fatt jgħidilna anki bħal ħafna nies jaħdmu fis-settur, il-pandemija għalqet ċertu bibien, minn band oħra forsi anki fetħet ċertu opportunitajiet oħra ta' kollaborazzjoni ta' xogħol ta' dan it-tip ta' ħidma fid-dinja tal-freelancers. Għamel ħafna xogħol xjentifiku u anki artistiku marbut dejjem mal-ħoss. U jekk naraw ftit anki l-kollaborazzjonijiet tiegħu anki fid-dinja akkademika, id-dottorat tiegħu għadu kemm kisbu fl-2021 minn Edinburgh Napier University. Ġewwa diskorsja fejn studja l-possibilità li l-ħoss jintuża bħala metodu ta' data analysis fil-livell ta' tfittix tal-pjaneti fis-sistema ta' dak li jissejjaħ exoplanets u exosolar systems. U ħajspjegalna mhux ħażin, jiġifieri għal min forsi anki jrid jisma l-affarijiet minn lenti xjentifika jaf ikun programm interessanti. Il-proċess magħruf bħala sonification huwa dak li fil-verità ħanifokaw ftit fuqu l-użu ta' ħoss li mhuwiex il-klim, li mhuwiex aħna, il-ħsejjes li nagħmlu bħala bnedmin permezz tal-klim biex jiġi rrappreżentat xi forma ta' data. Fil-Ġunju tal-2018 kien ikkollabraw ukoll ma' NASA il-Goddard Space Flight Center ġewwa Maryland biex propju jagħmel xogħol ma' astronomi u astrofiziċi illi kienu ħadmu fuq il-teleskopju Kepler illi kien qed iħares lejn dan it-teleskopju li propju kien qed ifittex il-pjaneti dak li jgħidu l-huma planet hunting il-kaċċa tal-pjaneti. Qabel mill-istess Università Edinburgh Napier Michael kien ġab il-MSc fil-design tal-ħoss u hemmhekk matul dak il-perjodu kien ħadem ħafna fuq soundscapes dak li jirċirkondana dak l-ambjenti li ngħixu fihom, però mill-lat tal-ħoss ta' dak li nisimgħu tal-ħsejjes li jirċirkondawna u kien ħadem partikolarment fuq l-ambjent soniku ta' Gżejjer Maltin u fil-fatt ħa nitħattu anke fuq dan l-aspett tax-xogħol tiegħu. Kien għamel ftit xogħol ta' Paragun ma' kollegi ġewwa Nikosija, Ċipru, gżira oħra qrib tagħna fil-Mediterran, partikolarment ma' Dr. Jannis Kristis ta' l-Università ta' Teknoloġija ta' Ċipru. Dik wasslet li twal proġetti oħra wkoll kif ħanisimgħu f'kollaborazzjoni mal-era mal-awtorità tal-ambjent u r-riżorsi. L-isfond tiegħu kif ħajdilna u jmur lura tassew ftit snin mhux ħażin fid-dinja tal-mużika tal-ħoss mal-band Spooky Monkey, forsi nista ta' tiegħi jew il-madwar jiftakru il-kunċerti wkoll tagħhom illi hu kien waqaf flimkien mal-kollegi tiegħu fil-band, u anki permezz ta' dak li jissejjaħ sintesi jew sampling, kien għamel ħafna xogħol li jaqgħad id-dinja astrofizika diġà f'dak iż-żmien tiegħu ta' pulsars u ta' solar flares flimkien mad-dinja tal-arti, tal-kreattività, u kif ħanisimgħu anke x-xogħol tiegħu fid-dinja tat-teatru u anki tal-film. So welcome back to the interview today on the program Min Campus Alijo here on Campus FM, where my guest, as you heard from the introduction in Maltese, is Michael Quinton. Michael, welcome and thank you very much for being with me on the show.
Thank you, Carsten. Thanks for the invitation.
As our listeners will have heard already, you're a sound designer, but that does not really do justice, I think, and does not really explain the interesting elements, contours, and various sides to what you do as a sound engineer, designer, but also this thing, in fact, of engineering keeps coming to my mind, a lapsus there, because there's not only maybe from a general layman's perspective, the designing of what you're doing, but you actually implement it, go out in the field, work it out. It's a craft. It's not only an element of a conceptual dimension, but there's actually the engineering side in the sense of actually making almost sound with sound, working out the sounds through the sounds that you record. So there's a lot of craft, there's a lot of implementation, only maybe from a layman's perspective, coming up with sort of a plan how to then have others maybe work on and implement. And as we'll be hearing, and let's start off straight away, today's program is maybe a bit quite different for listeners, because where usually the music element comes in, even when guests are maybe musicians by training, maybe in their childhood they had developed the artistic side. We've had guests who kept up their performing arts side later on in life as well, parallel to their career in a way. In our case today, maybe the words will come second to the sounds that we'll be hearing. And we've decided to somehow to structure our conversation around four blocks, roughly, loosely speaking, to take us through this itinerary. But let me start off in the traditional way and ask you, where did this start off? So, casting yourself back in time, where did sort of this interest, this work, and how did it sort of somehow set you off on the path you're on today?
Basically, I've always been very much into music. So as far as I can remember, I think the only thing that kept me quiet as a child was actually listening to music. So my mother always says that I was very hyperactive as a child, and the only thing that really kept me quiet was getting the pots and pans out and banging away on those. And she used to let me bang away for ages, so I made a hell of a racket, but anyway.
And bless her then, and look, yeah, and yeah. All those mothers and parents who sort of say, okay, go for it.
That's it. And apart from that, on my dad's side of the family in England, they were very much into music. And again, to keep me quiet, when I used to go to my uncle's house, he used to get me to listen to music all the time.
What was it that you listened at the time?
It was all sorts of music. My uncle had a very broad range of, you know, tastes. He wasn't into particular styles. And his sons were older than me, my cousins. Mm. And they were teenagers already, so they were getting into music. And they would record music for me, and I would just listen on tapes.
Ah, the old traditional way, which I remember as well.
That's right, yeah.
Thinking off radio or whatever. And then sort of listening at whatever time you want.
That's it. And my mother was always, she liked to keep the radio on at home, and I used to listen to that, and we had a record player with LPs. My father had a collection of soul records, so, you know, we used to put on the vinyl sometimes and listen rather than watching TV. So there was always this culture of actually listening, not just seeing things. I loved TV as a kid, but still the listening element was always there.
And this is sort of the original period. I remember my period as well in early 80s as a small child.
Yeah.
Being sort of allowed to work out how vinyl worked on my dad's vinyl.
That's
being
it.
Very proud of never scratching them. And it's true, gaining a culture of being in touch, physically in touch with the music you listen to.
Yes.
And being able then to listen rather than just watch, for example.
That's it. And at the time in England, Top of the Pops was the weekly thing.
We're talking about the, is it also 80s?
It's 80s, yeah. So, yeah, we're talking about, late 70s. I was born in 76, so I didn't get much of the 70s except for the radio elements. But Top of the Pops, I remember 1980. I remember bands like Depeche Mode starting and, I remember a lot of the tracks that we still listen to up until this day. New Order, there was Blue Monday coming out. Mm. I still remember that. I remember Gary Newman's Cars in 1979. And all these things really used to fascinate me, whole idea of synthesis as well. So there are a lot of new wave bands that were into synthesizers and stuff like that. And the sound of them always fascinated me so much. And I always wanted to play in a band.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved to Malta. I was around about 11, 12 at the time. And it's like went to secondary school. I met up with the co-founder of Spooky Monkey, Alex Bateri Gingell, at school. We used to go to school together. And we tried to get a hip-hop thing going on at the time. So hip-hop wasn't big in Malta at all. I kind of picked it up from England before I left. It was already coming in, and bands like Public Enemy were quite big at the time.
But here, quite sort of before its time.
Oh, yeah. No, you couldn't find these things. If you went to the local music stores, you couldn't find that kind of music.
And not even in the scene, from what I follow and understand from research done by people like Joshua DeGiorgio or Tony Sand, for example.
Yeah.
It wasn't the time for that.
It wasn't at all. No, not at all. But that kind of got me interested in, getting into music, buying instruments. I bought my first guitar, I think I was 15 at the time, around about 15. And even though I was learning how to play the guitar, I was already messing around to see how not to play the guitar conventionally.
Hmm.
It was an acoustic guitar, not an electric guitar, but playing around with rhythm on the body and stuff like that. And it's like my interest just started to grow exponentially at the time in sound. So it was like music. I bought my first electric guitar. I was a bit older than that. Then I bought my first effects pedals. I think I was about 18 at the time. And it was quite a good unit. It was a Digitech RP10, which was quite an elaborate guitarist pedal unit at the time. And I really started to experiment with sound effects and stuff like that. And me and Alex were already talking about, we were playing in other bands at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which never really picked up, but the whole idea of using technology.
You were in a way sowing the seeds for your own experiments.
That's it.
At the time and later on.
To
see where things were going. And the scene here locally would then be reflecting a bit more diversity moving on with the times, I guess, of connectedness as well on a European and even a global level was happening more because things were opening up.
It was still very... It was a strange time because it's like a lot of people wanted to open up in Malta, but it was still a time when you sent tape demos to record labels abroad and never got back. They never got back to you or anything like that. A lot of people wanting to go into music, but obviously the scene was limited. It's limited geographically because it's small. So even if you're playing live, there are only so many venues you can play at and so many gigs you can do. And, even though you got a loyal following, but even that over time, it's going to be...
It gets a bit exhausted.
Yeah, people are going to get...
Or exhausting sometimes because you get the same feeling and maybe sometimes sort of stuck in the rut of...
Kind of, yeah.
Not really changing much.
But I don't think it was just about the live performance. I really got into the idea of recording. And I did my first sound engineering course. It was a diploma course. I was about, I think, 20 at the time. It was just before we kicked off with Spooky Monkey. And we were getting into buying synthesizers at the time as well and buying samplers for sampling stuff. And I got into the habit, I bought a tape recorder at the time, which was a portable recorder. Very cheap, but it gave me access to recording the world. And I used to love to travel. I used to go abroad, take the tape recorder with me and record all sorts of things. And it was interesting, we spent I think it was almost a month traveling from country to country. Mm-hmm. Started off in Prague, then went up to St. Petersburg, and then moved on to Tallinn and Estonia, then to Helsinki, then back down to Prague, and then around the Czech Republic. And mm-hmm. it was a whole month of traveling, and I was just taking recordings of all sorts of things. It was interesting because it was the post-Soviet period. So,
how interesting, because my mind is sort of thinking about maybe even other people on the show who describe maybe more recent times and travel and work across Europe, for example, mostly post Malta's having joined the European Union. Mm-hmm. But here we're talking about a good 10, 15 years earlier.
That's
but riding the sort of maybe wave of enthusiasm, but also fear, also uncertainty, which came after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so, yeah.
Yeah. It was an interesting time because a lot of these countries were kind of trying to find their way. They were different. We, at the time, because of the Iron Curtain, we didn't know much about these countries in the first place, so that was interesting to start discovering cultures which were a bit more exotic than the cultures, mm-hmm. even though they were European, but, yeah, there was a difference in, slight difference in things, and the mentality. And so I found that interesting, going around with the tape recorder and collecting these, you know, these snippets of reality from different countries.
Michael, in fact, let's listen to one of your works in collaboration, even at the time, inspiring the work with Spooky Monkey, Logan's World, which reflected a bit the spirit of yours, capturing these sounds internationally. That, Michael, was an interesting combination of your research with the creative side.
Obviously, then you get creative, so you think, I can use these recordings and put them into music. And so the musical composition at the time of Spooky Monkey was experimenting with all these different sounds that we used to capture, and plus as well the electronics and sampling. And, I think then from there on, I just continue to get curious about the way sound works. And with the sound engineering course, I kind of got an idea of, you know, the way sound waves are working and the mechanics of sound.
That's what I was going to say, yes, how they worked out.
That's it.
Before we go on to this track, excuse the pun, Michael, my guest today, Michael Quinton, on Min Campus Elihor, I just wanted to say this sort of absorbing of many sources mm-hmm. and then applying them to your craft, which is sort of, as you said, you become creative, so you start seeing what to do with them. It reminds me, coincidentally, in parallel, also another other art form. So yours is very unobtrusive, because having a tape recorder is sort of much simpler than videoing, mm-hmm. maybe even in terms of people not wanting to be sort of seen a bit as exotic animals being recorded. Mm-hmm. But you remind me of also some writers like Emmanuel Mifsud, for example, who at the time was really looking at, let's call them Eastern European cultures and countries. I remember once being lucky to travel with him to Bosnia about 2001 on an arts festival which Unitsamed allowed us to participate in. And there's sort of this capturing of a perspective from Malta of cultures like Czech Republic, and there were many people, I think, who I can think of, who were sort of exploring these European perspectives and dynamics. But not only that, or maybe not, let's say, only from an anthropological perspective mm-hmm. or a cultural perspective, but actually then feeding their art, feeding their craft with it, and then transferring it, as you said, into your own work and compositions. So what happened next?
Basically, I mean, we were commissioned to work on a project which was about the origin of life with the artist Lisa Falson at the time. And she just let us, she gave us free rein to just tackle it from any angle we wanted to. She showed us the artworks, samples of the artworks, and so we picked on all the different aspects of what origin is, you know, where do we come from, and all this. And at the time we were looking at stuff like pulsars and solar flares, and we're listening to actual audifications, which I learned later, are what happens is you get like pulsars are working as radio waves in space. And if you grab these radio waves and you translate them to our audible range, so what that means is that you pitch down. These are pulsating at very fast speeds.
To what we can
hear, because it's a wave. It's the same as a sound wave, basically. Mm-hmm. It's just we give waves different names because we need to classify them.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what astronomers are doing is, in order to hear the pulses, because this is how pulses were discovered, it was through using this audification process, because using paper graphs. I think the first paper graphs they used when they first heard pulses were like so long, they were like kilometers long, so they couldn't go through them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What they did is they put sound through a speaker and they could hear a constant pulse. And
realized there was something out there.
First they called it little green men.
Mm.
They thought they found an extraterrestrial civilization. Then they realized it wasn't that. They realized, you know, through further analysis that it was actually a star that turns on itself at such a high speed it creates these radio pulses. So the waves obviously are constant, and you get this you know, constant rhythm coming through.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we found that really interesting. Okay, outer space is actually like a musical composition when you look at it. If all these bodies in space are moving and vibrating, and they're giving off waves, like radio waves, light waves as well. You get light wave emissions. This is what we collect for astronomy as well. And gamma rays, X-rays, you name it. There's so many different cosmic rays that are all working. These are all waves. And basically, if we translate these by pitching them down to our audible range, then we can hear them.
Yes.
And we can hear the composition.
Yes. It's interesting. You make me think of the way both the Greeks, and then even in medieval times, the belief that stars issued music, they made sound, is very true. They did not have all this possibility of capturing the pulses, which is a more recent phenomenon, but somehow they did chart the stars and the skies, not only from a visual perspective and from an astronomical and later astrological perspective, but also sound-wise. So the fact that there is music in the stars and the sky is what you're telling us.
Well, you got the famous harmony of the spheres,
the
movement of everything working in perfect ratios to each other, and these ratios are keeping everything in balance, which, you know, we did actually discover later on through time that the way that a solar system keeps its planets all in orbit is through harmonic resonance and through equal ratios. And these ratios allow the planets to coexist around a star. You've got to think of the system rather than being, you know, a sun with separate entities. Think of it as a whole entity in itself. The whole solar system is like that. And everything is working like the cells work in our body, or atoms work in our, you know, in everything.
And all the rotations. Basically.
All the different
and
rotations.
Combinations together.
What we're still trying to figure out is, you know, when you get all these systems working together, is how they are affecting each other.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're, you know, finally with telescope technology that we have and radio telescope technology nowadays, we can start to see these harmonic relationships between different solar systems. The galaxy is an entity in itself as well. So, you know, this is where, this was so mind-boggling for me. It was like, wow, I've got to learn more about this. You know, it's like, if the whole of existence is like a musical composition, then we're getting a very, very small...
It's more range.
Range of that, because our hearing range is extremely limited compared to all that.
Michael, before we started and preparing for the program, we set out a chart of what to listen to, how, and how to relate things together. But from what you're saying, there's a few tracks, a bit of work that you've done, which takes me to this dimension, to this sphere. So your tracks that look at asteroid collisions, and water vapor with noise, what you told me are sonifications. Shall we start off with those?
We could do.
Because it seems to sort of somehow maybe add a bit of a musical dimension to what we've been saying, and our listeners might listen a little bit to what you're saying. Let's listen to a bit of asteroid collisions, and maybe then you can tell us a little bit about it.
Okay.
And then move on.
Okay.
So just to reassure our listeners, their radio sets or their computer, if they're listening to Min Campus Alihor online, didn't sort of go funny. And it's not a very intense table tennis game either. what are you listening to there? Michael Quinton, my guest today on Campus FM.
Basically, that was it was a sonification. So a sonification is the representation of using non-verbal sound to represent data. Okay. For that specific sonification, what we were looking at, the exosolar system called the Beta Pictoris system. And astronomers were able to observe that there was a huge asteroid belt revolving around the star, the parent star, called Beta Pictoris. But they were suspecting that there was a planet orbiting within the midst of the asteroid belt. They couldn't see it because you can't really see these things. When you're picking up exosolar planetary data, a lot of it is due to light dips or radio waves and the emissions. And we kind of get an impression through observing the repeated patterns of these things.
So we can't sort of see or hear everything yet.
They're too far.
But through patterns, through what we can't see or hear, maybe, because there's something blocking the way, then we realize that there's something else.
And
we fit in the pieces.
Well, what they could observe in the case of this system, they could see that the actual asteroid belt had been warped. So it, rather than being a flat plate, it took on the shape of more of a, let's say, an S shape, okay, but S shape to the side, right, on a flat level.
And, so it's a bit more like a wave.
A bit like a wave, yeah. If you, that's a better way of explaining it, yeah. So you've got like a wave, and that wave could only be the result of something moving within the belt. But again, they could collect the asteroid data of collisions, because what happens is that they could mathematically calculate through the light dips the occurrence of a kind of ripple effect going on within the system. But they couldn't really detect if the planet was there. They started to build a 3D model of this and, you know, putting in the mathematical equations, and it seemed like there was a planet there, but they still weren't 100%. Mm-hmm. So the astronomer I worked with assumed that by using sound, you could actually detect if the planet was there. So she gave me the asteroid data, and I used a system of user experience design. So it's not just about coming up with sounds that you think is good. The astronomer has to be able to understand the data sonically. Now, that's hard, because it's hard to... Sound is quite abstract, first and foremost. In order for people to be able to decode what they're listening to, they need to know what the parameters are. The method of sonification there is called parameter mapping sonification. So what you're doing is you're going through the data and you're saying, right, what's our scales here? So we've got a range of, let's say, from 0 to 20. We need to represent everything in between 0 to 20.
That's your range.
That's your range. Now, that's the astronomical range, not your hearing range. So now we need to translate that into the hearing range. Now, normally humans, like we said, we hear between 20 and 20 kilohertz or 20,000 hertz, which are cycles per second. So you're hearing at 20 hertz, you're hearing 20 times per second, okay? 20,000 hertz means you're hearing 20,000 times per second. That's the wave, the sound wave. Now, most humans, especially if you're over 40 like myself, you've stopped hearing up until 20 kilohertz. You're hearing much less because the ear over time starts to wear, and the small hairs in your inner ear start to become very brittle, and they don't vibrate properly, so they don't replicate the higher frequencies properly. Now, even though this astronomer was younger than that, but you're trying to build a model that can be used by a range of people, so even people over their 40s or 50s, you want them to hear the data, basically.
Yes.
Another thing I did, I used a thing which is called auditory affordances. And that means that what you're doing is you're working with association. So I asked her, I said, how do you imagine these asteroid collisions? And she said, I imagine it sounding like breaking ice.
Mm.
Breaking ice, rocks colliding, mm-hmm, and stuff mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. And so I started listening to the way that ice starts to break. You hear like a poo kind of sound. It's weird. And it's not, you don't imagine it like a the big, you know, glacier breaking. We're talking about ice starting to break here when it's still solidified. And I started to replicate that sound as much as I could with the sonification. But at the same time, what we wanted to do spatially, we wanted to show that the planet is passing through the belt, mm-hmm, if it is there.
Mm-hmm.
So the asteroid collisions have got coordinates. And we started to map out the coordinates going between left and right ear, so you could hear it on a stereo system. And we got it to work on a surround system as well, so you could hear the asteroid belt revolving around wow. your head. So there we're playing with the perspective. Mm-hmm. The astronomer could look at the actual solar system from a distance and see it as a flat plane, and then actually be in the middle of it, taking the heliocentric position and hearing it as if they are the star in the middle, hearing
in the middle
the belt.
With everything revolving around, yeah. around yourself. So there's a lot of, and we're coming a bit later to this, we have a lot of mapping.
Yes.
But mapping which is very mobile,
mm-hmm.
and not only on the ground, but we're starting off from the stars.
Exactly.
Michael, there's another track, Water Vapor with Noise, where you also work on this element of sonification and mapping. Shall we listen to that?
Yep.
So once again, back with Michael Quinton on Campus Alihor. I did tell our listeners a bit of a different program, very, very oral, very set on sounds and what we're listening to. Just a little word about water vapor with noise there, these sort of very almost Martian sounds that we were listening to.
Yeah, basically that was the atmosphere of an exoplanet, and you get different chemical compositions or in an atmosphere. This particular astronomer wanted to study water vapor in this planetary atmosphere. The planet is in a zone called the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone. So it's assumed that the planet is in the right kind of range that the Earth is in, that there could be possible life on the planet. So they're looking at water here to see, you know, if the atmosphere is similar to ours in comparison to the
I guess
water.
Now I guess why the Goldilocks connection comes in. So is anyone
That's it, yes.
Is anyone there?
That's it. So basically with this sonification, there were two sounds here. There was the actual water vapor, but there was the noise as well. So the telescope is capturing a high amount of noise, which comes from light from other stars, dust particles reflecting light, and the heat of the telescope itself creating noise,
okay.
You see? So all this is unwanted, and what happens is it masks the original signal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the astronomer wanted to see if there had been any water vapor that had been masked.
Yeah.
So we managed, what we did is we got the water vapor working on the left ear, the noise working on the right ear, and then we had the two crossing each other according to the intensity of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was more water vapor, it would shift to the right ear. If there was more noise, mm-hmm. it would shift mm-hmm. to the left ear. And that
you'd capture those.
What you've done is you've got rid of the masking, and you can hear anything mm-hmm. that's going mm-hmm. on.
So somehow you're filtering out what could have been sort of
kind of
yeah. itself onto.
Although you're leaving it there, you're just using space to play
separate,
around.
To separate that.
And the astronomer immediately detected an element of water vapor that he hadn't noticed before.
Because
mm-hmm. you hear it just pops out of the mix mm-hmm. straight away.
And once you know what you're looking out for, or better in this case, listening into, then you can identify that.
Exactly. And that's why, again, it was designed so that he could understand mm-hmm, what he was mm-hmm, listening mm-hmm. to, rather than me just coming up and saying, right, let's do it this way.
Yeah, Michael, and we'll soon stop to have a sort of a traditional musical pause, and we're already doing a lot of, saying a lot, in a lot of good time here. But there's still a lot to talk about and listen to. So before we do that, I just wanted to say somehow, this is really important what you said, knowing what you're out to find mm-hmm. Somehow sort of setting those parameters. You talked about sort of somehow seeing where you're operating, drawing the margins, and knowing that if this is your range and this is your field, working there and then moving on, very sort of methodologically, very strategically. Mm-hmm. That's something which is really, to me, being very clear. Let's move to a track which you've composed on the back of all this experience, Spaceman in Edinburgh. And we'll also sort of relax a little bit, even our listeners, who are grappling with all the asteroids and spatial dynamics. Let's listen to it. My guest today on the program in Campus Elihu is Michael Quinton, sound designer, to me also so much more though, because then now we've spoken a lot about space and the sound that, the galaxies emit, and somehow how this is captured and mapped and planned. However, with Spaceman in Edinburgh, there's always the spatial connection. However, so we're introducing a little look at also your creative, your artistic work, because Michael, you work a lot also with you did mention already visual artists, but there's also plays. In fact, while we're recording this towards the end of 2021, you're busy with lots of, I see your name popping up in a number of productions. They say, how are you managing all that? With people like Leanne, Abel, Antonia, Tar, that's Spazio Creative. In fact, introducing that theme, after having listened to Spaceman in Edinburgh, we'll soon pass to listen to some work you did on a play and The Decision. I wonder whether you can say something briefly about sort of this. Well, I don't know if it's a transition or if it's all, again, tracks in parallel that you do between sort of the sound capture and the creativity of it.
Well, basically, with Spaceman in Edinburgh, that was just the artistic break from the scientific stuff I was doing with the sonifications. I needed to get back to music. And I had my musical instruments with me in Edinburgh, and I could jam a bit, and I just recorded a few jams and put a track together just for some mental headspace for myself, really. So that's really delving away from the scientific stuff that I was doing. I didn't even include any of the sonifications in the track. It's a typical funk track that's got nothing to do with... But again, it was kind of reflecting myself at the time, that, you know, even though I am the scientist, but I can't forget that I'm the artist as well. It was very important to keep that connection. And at the time, I was working on a music for a theatre play, and I composed The Decision as a musical piece which came into one of the scenes that was going to be in the play. That was an interesting play, because again, I used sampling, and in that case, I was using samples from from kitchen stuff lying around, pots and pans. So I went back to the pots and pans, which, you know, started off from my childhood. There was a reason for that decision. Basically, I mean, the play was based around a female character and the whole idea of the female archetype being manifested on, you know, on a very wide scale and showing, you know, quite a deep reflection of the female psyche. So I decided to use the kitchenware because of, you know, the whole the antiquated idea of the woman's place at home, mm-hmm. being in the kitchen, maybe the frustration that could have brought about and stuff like that, you know, and how we tend to fit into roles which society give us, which doesn't necessarily mean that we're part of that thing. So that was an interesting break as well from the sonification work. I needed to keep the musical stuff going because to create a sound design, that you've still got to think, not really in musical terms, but sound aesthetic terms. And in music, you get that a lot, especially if you're working with multiple instruments and you want it to sound like a coherent piece. Then this is where you're really looking at the type of sounds you're choosing for the musical composition.
For it to come together and make sense.
Because, you know, you can get any sound and compose, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to sound good.
So, Michael, let's listen to a piece from the decision.
Okay.
Yesterday, Michael, Quentin was telling me during listening to this track, The Decision, from Medea Decides, the play, that there's this particular technique, idea that you use the Shepherd's Stone to reflect. And you were telling me how taking this technique, you were sort of really trying not only to follow what's happening on stage, but actually introduce and reflect and comment on what's happening.
Yeah, so the Shepherd's Stone is an auditory illusion, and it gives the illusion of constantly spiraling up or down, depending on how you set the pitch to go either up or down. And in this case, I used it to show degeneration of the character. So the Shepherd tone is actually going down. It just goes down, 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 constantly throughout the track. But it's an illusion. It's not actually doing that because there's only a limit of how far down you can go with pitch. So you're actually repeating it, but you make it continuous. And the mind is tricked into believing that the sound is constantly
going down all the time. Rather than looping up and down again.
Yeah.
But you're getting that illusion.
That's it. And it's interesting because people who'd listened to it commented that they felt this falling sensation all the time. Mm. And that was the idea. Hans Zimmer used this similar technique. He uses it in his compositions, especially when working with Christopher Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Batman movies, he used the Shepherd's Stone quite a lot. And he used it the other way round, which was going up all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So his musical compositions and even the sound design of the bike that Batman is actually riding at one point, the sound keeps getting higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
and it's showing constant acceleration, and it's building intensity and tension, and the audience is suspense. So that's a really clever way, you know, how to use it both from a sound design point of view and from a musical composition point of view.
Yeah. Michael, we're in the last part of our interview today. Really interesting. I guess our listeners too are sort of piecing all these elements together. And we started off with sort of your traveling and your early days. We moved up into outer space, but then also landed a little bit more into plays. We were talking also during the music about your work with Spooky Monkey and film and animation. We'll keep coming closer to our level, our ground. And maybe as one of the last elements I wanted to ask you about was more recent work. And I think that was around the time when we started talking and speaking about the possibility of having a program together, with sort of commissioned work as well this time, but of a very different nature, taking us down to sort of ground level and soundscapes, and this time also reflecting very much realities and imagined soundscapes and real soundscapes in Malta through a project commissioned by ERA. Can you, the Environmental Resource Agency, can you tell us something about this? And we'll listen to a few tracks now.
Basically, I mean, what ERA wanted to do, they wanted to get a better impression of the Silent City of Mdina. Mm. Now, that, you know, the name Silent City, sonic, okay?
Right, so,
and they were wondering, like, okay, is it really as silent as we imagine it to be? And I was commissioned to do a study where what we were going to do is we were going to look at Mdina by recording for 3 months. It was 3 times a week, every 2 weeks. And what we were trying to get a pattern to see if we can see what the main activities are going on in the city, what the main sounds are, and then start seeing like the way that this, we measured 5 sites, which are always the same throughout the whole 3 month period. And we wanted to see if there would be any changes. This was post-COVID lockdown last year in 2020. We started in July, went all the way to September. So here the soundscapes changed. Unfortunately, because we didn't get to measure that before the lockdown, we couldn't compare to how it was before and how COVID actually affected this. So it was really interesting because in this case, the level of activity of tourism, of people actually visiting the city, a lot of it had gone quiet. Not as quiet as we suspected. There was still activity going on because the lockdown had ended at the time.
Yes.
People could go out.
So there was a revival of a number of things.
There were a revival of a number of things. And it was interesting because what we started to discover is that, okay, it's called the Silent City. It's interesting because you've got a lot of activity going on, which makes it quite noisy. But the city itself and the way it's designed due to its narrow alleyways and smaller streets and smaller squares, you get these silent pockets. And it's so quiet in these pockets that you can hear the minutest of details, which you wouldn't normally hear if you're in a busier metropolis, so to speak.
Michael, we've got lined up 3 tracks here, which in terms of description reflect the Cathedral Square, the Greek Gate, and St. Paul's Gate.
Yeah.
Let's listen to pieces of them and then comment a little bit about them. So very clear soundscape there, absolutely not quiet, absolutely not silent with Cathedral Square. Could you say something about sort of certain moments you chose? I know you recorded that on the day of Santa Maria, 15th August. So
that's right, yeah.
You were sort of not just turning up, but choosing also where and when to go in certain occasions.
Yeah, that was quite coincidental, actually. It happened to fall into the timetable that we had blocked, and it was one of those 2 weeks that we managed to.
So a bit of serendipity there, is it?
So yeah, that's it. It was a nice coincidence, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very important because those bells were rang in particular to show solidarity for the whole island. It wasn't just ringing the bells in Mdina. I think all the churches had agreed to ring the bells to give people courage
during the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an interesting sort of record and testimony, really,
mm-hmm.
of
yeah.
not only what we see, but also what we're hearing here, mm-hmm. what we're experiencing. So that was Cathedral Square. Let's have a listen to Grigate. Mm-hmm. Very different sounds there this time, Michael. My guest, Michael Quinton on Campus Elihor. Birds, yes, and yep. Grigate and Mdina in July.
Yep, nesting in the wall. And it seemed like the birds had given birth to a lot of new birds, mm-hmm. and they were feeding them at that period of time. And it's interesting because at the Grigate it's actually quieter. This is one of the quiet spots in Mdina. So that sound was like, it was just everywhere. And I was in St. Nicholas Street further up just a few minutes before taking another recording, and I was capturing those birds from there as well. Obviously sounded different because I was further away from the wall, but it was a very intense sound. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful, very natural sound. So this is the thing with soundscapes. What you're looking at is what sounds you want to preserve and what mm-hmm. sounds you want to mitigate, so to speak. It's a different approach to the noise abatement, where what you're doing is just looking at loud sounds and turning them down or getting rid of them. This is kind of integrating, kind of retuning the environment, harmonizing the environment. So you see there's a relationship here with the planetary stuff. It's about creating harmony again, but in our environment and our surroundings. Because apparently this has an effect on our well-being,
yes.
which is taken for granted, because we don't really take notice of what we're listening to.
Yeah.
So a sound like that is it's really soothing, even though it's mm-hmm. intense. Mm-hmm. But actually standing there with the recorder for 5 minutes, so the original recording is 5 minutes long, and collecting that, it kind of gave me a sense of peace, a sense mm-hmm. of serenity.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to say, right, that's very different to traffic sounds, which kind of get me on edge.
Yes.
So you see, this is where
I think that's something many of us can relate to.
And what you could do with soundscapes to mask the sound of traffic, which is probably a hindrance to people, you can start laying down bushes and trees mm-hmm. to attract birds mm-hmm. to come back to use those spaces. And then with that singing, that's within rough mm-hmm. frequency range where it will mask a lot of the sound coming from traffic. You see, so this is where you're using nature itself to reharmonize the environment.
That's right. That was July. August of the same year, you recorded this at St. Paul's Gate. Let's listen to this. Mm-hmm. And that was typical to me, as I was telling you, of summer, the cicadas, and
yeah.
that beautiful sound over there.
Mm-hmm. That was at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was peak time, for heat, and it was an interesting recording.
Mm-hmm. Michael, we're at the end of our interview with lots of sounds which we tried to sort of describe and talk about and somehow meld into your own path in the development of what you do in terms of sound design. I guess, however, as we started off with a sort of a traditional question, I'll also end off with sort of, as I was telling you before, sort of what's cooking in the kitchen, taking you back maybe to the pots and pans. What are your current or immediate future projects? What's on the pipeline?
So with the soundscape stuff, we've got more projects coming up in relation to that. So this is where, again, we're going to be studying the sound of a different area and, comparing that to findings in Mdina. This is all related to a past study I had done, starting to look at the soundscape of Malta. We'd like to dig into that in more detail. Again, working with ERA in this case. I can't disclose too much information, but anyway, that's just a small taster of. With I'm also experimenting with a virtual reality at the moment, and looking into the prospects of performing live as a musical band in the metaverse, in virtual reality. We've been working on that for some time with Spooky Monkey once again, so we've got the band up and running after both of us being abroad for a long time. And we're looking into, the idea stems from the whole COVID thing where a lot of people couldn't perform. Yeah. And we thought, right, virtual reality might be a space to actually discover and even look at the creative potential of how you could change the live performance format, you see. Mm-hmm. We're used to having a certain format. Whereas I think virtual reality allows people to play around with that and give the audience new experiences as well. So we're really looking into how much we can stretch the medium, how much we can push it, looking at the technological limitations that will either hinder or allow us to do this. So it still works in progress. And there's still a lot of research to be done.
And there's a lot of things in flux.
Yes.
And change.
Exactly.
And I think, I'm sure actually, my listeners today, listening to Michael Quinton speak with me, and the sounds you've recorded and created and sort of melded it together, will have got this feeling of things being very much in flux and ever changing.
Yes.
And somehow rather than capturing them, and fossilizing them and freezing them, it's more of giving them a new dimension and seeing where everything can go.
Well, this is sound. It's elusive and ever-changing. So, you know, I think the best way to capture it is to work on that, because rather than getting, you know, stuck and, you know, trying to solidify it, you can't. Let's give it that elusive spirit and see, you know, where it takes us, because I think there's still a lot of questions to be answered. And I think sound is an extremely important aspect in our lives that we overlook simply because hearing comes so naturally to us.
Yeah, it's true. Michael, thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you, Carsten. Thank you for your time.
Nittama li l-intervist tal-lum ma' Michael Quinton oġbitkom f-tid-differenti, f-fukata ħafna fuq il-ħsejjes, fejn il-ħoss u l-mużika kienu tassew il-protagonisti. Nirringrazzjakom tal-li kontu miegħi l-lum u nittama li t-naqdu miegħi għal-programmi ħor fis-sensiera minn Campus għal-ieħor.